Hi, everyone. Welcome to another interview episode of V the People. I wanted to just give a quick little preface to this episode before it plays. First of all, it was such a crazy honor and just all around experience to have the opportunity to interview Maria Rodale. I really thank her for taking the time to sit down with me. And of course, of all the days that I could be unprepared for something, it would be for this interview. Not that it was a lack of preparation, but I had some technical difficulties with one of my microphones. And, you know, I'm just a homegrown little studio. I'm not in a big fancy office where I can just quickly call, you know, a tech person. So it's just me. And last minute, Maria and I made it work and quite literally shared a microphone passing back and forth. So you will notice that I am loud and she is not. It's not too much of a crazy difference, but I just wanted to apologize in advance for any manual adjustments you might have to make. I'm probably making it sound way worse than it actually is. I did take the time to go through and edit as best I could, but normally I'm able to match volumes much easier. So, you know, just bear with me. It is so worth it to listen to what she has to say. I learned so much, and I actually left the interview feeling the most empowered and confident about my body than I have in a really long time. So I hope it gives you that same feeling. I hope you enjoy the episode. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for sticking with me through all the ups and downs. And, you know, maybe one day we'll be in a fancy studio together. All right, enjoy. So normally when I introduce people, I just kind of wing it, but I feel like you're so decorated that I wanted to make sure. So I wrote out your introduction. Are you ready? Okay, everyone. Maria Rodale is an author, activist, and lifelong advocate for organic agriculture and healthy living. As the former CEO and chairman of Rodale Inc. and a leader at the Rodale Institute, she has helped shape some of the biggest conversations around food, farming, health, and the environment in America. She's the author of several books, including Organic Manifesto and Love Nature Magic. And these days, her work blends environmental conviction with a deeply personal voice on nature, culture, and the future we're creating. And on a personal note, she worked with my wife at Rodale for about 7 years and is genuinely one of my wife's favorite humans. So I thank you so much for being here and welcome to V the People.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and I love Kathleen and you. So it's an honor.
Well, thank you. And we're sharing a microphone today because today of all days, I'm having technical difficulties, but that's okay because I told Maria, you're going to be doing a lot of the talking, which is okay. This was really the first time that I felt like I had to do just so much research because you're so multifaceted and I didn't want to ask you all the same things. So I'm just going to dive right into it. All right. Okay. Your recent writing feels less like traditional environmental commentary and more like a manifesto about rage, pleasure, beauty, and power. What changed in your voice and why now?
Well, that's an interesting perception. And it's a conscious shift that started from two things. One is I sold the publishing company, so I didn't have to represent a business or employees or anything like that. So I could be more my true self. And then the other thing was like really through all my learnings and research and discovery, I realized like you can lecture people all you want about you know, what to eat or what not to eat, or, you know, the importance of the environment. But until we all change our hearts and our the way we think about the world, it doesn't really matter. Nothing changes.
I just watched that documentary called All of the Empty Rooms. Have you heard about that? It's the CBS journalist who, yeah, and at the end of it, he said, I wish every American could stand in one of these rooms for just a few minutes. So I feel like that's exactly what you're saying. Like, it has to be intrinsic. Okay, so you've spent years talking about organic agriculture in terms of health, soil, and systems, but lately you've been talking about it through a lens of sacredness, which I feel is kind of what you're referring to. What does the word sacredness mean to you?
Sacred means that it's holy, you know, godlike, goddess-like, should be approached with reverence and care and love. But to me, like, everything is sacred. So that's just, it should be a way of being in the world where everything is important and special and deserving of love and care. Whether that's the soil or friendship or partners or pets or houses.
My wife always says that going to your house is like food for the soul, literally. Okay, so your recent quotes and interviews / writing feels more free. So I feel like that was you talking about not having to necessarily represent a company. When did you really start to feel like you could kind of veer from that legacy? And what does it feel like to just write whatever you want?
So when I wrote Love, Nature, Magic, it was a very scary book for me to write because it kind of outed me as somebody who talks to plants and animals and nature and, you know, does shamanic journeying, which is something I do without drugs, just, you know, with the sound of a drum. And when it was about to go to, you know, be published, my publishing company said, you should start a Substack. And I was like, you know, they're like, it'll help you build your platform. And so I was like, okay, I used to be a blogger in the olden days. I had a blog called Maria's Farm Country Kitchen, which I really enjoyed, mostly recipes. So the great thing about Substack is that you can experiment and you see the results, you see the data, like what does well, what doesn't well, what doesn't do well. And, you know, I'm a former circulation manager, so I really like seeing that kind of data and seeing, you know, what links do people click on and, you know, which posts get the most response. And what I started to notice is that the more angry I was and the more I cursed, the more people loved it. But also, you know, not just angry, but like angry on behalf of women and children. So my top post of all time is a letter to men who want women to have more children. You know, because it's like, I've got three kids. It's not easy. It's really hard. And the whole debate that's happening in the, you know, America right now about, you know, anti-abortion or women just, you know, should stay at home and have kids. It's like, fuck you. Fuck you.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Yes. And then, so when I saw that people not only didn't mind me doing that, but actually liked it, I was like, well, what's holding me back? You know, nothing. Because, you know, honestly, truthfully, you know, I don't need, because I sold the company, I don't need the money. I'm not, you know, trying to make a living. I'm not trying to sell sponsorships. I don't want to be an influencer. I just want the freedom to say whatever the fuck I want.
Hell freaking yes. Do you think, I would imagine people who knew you really well weren't surprised by your views, but did you get any backlash? Were you worried about it? was there anyone in your circle that was surprised by it?
I don't think, I mean, people who knew me well knew this side of me. I don't think, you know, I'm not like worried about whether people will advertise with me because I don't take advertising. So, you know, sometimes I'm concerned about, you know, I'm the co-chair of the board of the Rodale Institute, and I don't want to like offend anybody at the Institute or, you know, our supporters. But, you know, the interesting thing about the Rodale Institute is that it's not partisan. And honestly, I think if you really read all my posts, ultimately, I kind of actually am more of a centrist than hard left or hard right. And
for people who don't know, can you explain what the Rodale Institute does?
So the Rodale Institute is a nonprofit that does scientific research on regenerative organic agriculture, comparing it to chemical GMO agriculture, and then also trains farmers who want to be regenerative organic farmers, and educates people about the benefits of being regenerative organic. And we also have a consulting arm that helps farmers who are chemically oriented, who want to transition to organic. So again, we welcome everybody, and we want to help everybody. You know, what we stand for though is nature and the sacredness of nature and how that impacts each of us and our health and our children's health and the food that we eat.
I have so many things circulating in my mind. I'm like thinking about all of the promises that this administration made to farmers and how much they're struggling. Do you see that happening firsthand? And what do you say to help them? Or what kind of hope do you hold on to?
Loaded.
So I personally do not work directly with farmers right now. I am more in touch with writers about farming. And like one of my favorite writers right now is a guy named Art Cullen in Iowa, who, you know, it's like the view from inside. So Iowa has the second highest cancer rates. Their water is completely polluted. And they've like voted Republican for, you know, 50 years or 40 years or something. And, you know, so it really helps reading him to understand why it is that way. And that's why, like, in, you know, when you asked me in the beginning, it's not just, if it was logical, everybody would be doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's not logical. It's emotional. So somehow we have to, like, tell better stories about how people can change and still be loved and financially secure and keep their farms. And it's happening a little bit, but it's not happening as much as it should. So, you know, I definitely don't want to be the kind of person that, you know, that says like, you are a Republican, so you're a bad person. You're not, you know, you just made a mistake. No, we'll forgive you.
<In time. laughs>
But I'm not the one being harmed by that. The farmers are being harmed. Mm-hmm. And that's what's heartbreaking. Well, financially, they're being harmed. Their health is being harmed. I mean, the cancer rates in Iowa, that's harming them. They've been told also that, you know, they have to have bigger and bigger farms. And that's a complicated economic situation where they're growing commodity-based things, so the more you grow, actually, the lower the price of the stuff. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, somehow aren't, like, registering that, so they just keep thinking, oh, I just got to grow more. But then what happens is the farms get bigger, and the towns, like, there's not as many people to support the town, so, like, the schools close, and the, you know, main streets kind of get abandoned. So, they're doing it to themselves, mm-hmm. and it's tragic. And then they want help, and the people get, you know, the people that the government are bailing out are the, you know, the ginormous farmers who are already rich and probably, like, you know, making money on other stuff. So it's a big problem. Mm-hmm.
I feel like I could listen to you talk about it all day because it's so interesting. This is probably a silly question, but just like for people who never think about this, are you saying that obviously the science links soil health to cancer?
There is indisputable science that links chemical use to cancer. And what the chemicals do to the soil is they kill the life in the soil. And then the soil can't hold water, so it leads to more flooding. And also, you know, in droughts, the soil isn't as resilient. So that's not even what we eat. That's just how things are grown and what goes into the water. And then we eat that stuff. And, you know, I'm not saying, I think there's a lot of things that cause cancer. It's sure. Like there's no one thing. It's the whole thing. And that's why, to me, it's important to look at, like, well, what is nature telling us about what we're doing? And if nature isn't happy, that means like our bodies aren't happy.
I love it. I honestly could listen. And you've instilled that in my wife hardcore. Like, I once bought a few bags of mulch that I didn't realize had weed repellent in them. That girl was like, you better turn that car around right now. And I had like loaded it and unloaded it. And I could see the look in her eyes. And I was like, there's no way I'm getting away with this. I mean, and I would actually love for you to come like check out our soil this summer, because I feel like we have so many bugs. Whenever I'm gardening, there's some garden snakes in there and I just leave them be. And I feel like it's just like a really happy little garden. So thank you for instilling that in my wife. Okay. And also, I do just want to say, this is a quick segue, that whenever we go to your house for a meal, it's exactly what people would think it is, where it's like the most delicious salad I've ever had in my life. And you're like, oh yeah, I just threw that together. It feels like if you were really, and I know you're probably like, this is such a people pleaser question to ask, but like if you were really trying to impress someone with a meal, would you focus more on just like what is in season and what feels good? Or do you ever focus on like a really kind of like exquisite or impressive dish?
Well, I will tell you an inside story for people who know who Alice Waters and Michael Pollan are. So first of all, the key is simplicity and in season, fresh. That's it. So Alice Waters is like considered the mother of fine dining, organic farm to table. You know, her restaurant Chez Panisse in Berkeley is like the holy grail for a lot of people. And a number of years ago, she came to my house for dinner. And so that, you know, oh my, I was like, oh my God, what do you cook for Alice Waters? And so, you know, I actually cooked her like a traditional Pennsylvania Dutch meal. Oh, cool. You know, ham and string beans and potatoes. And but the salad was like fresh greens from a farmer friend of mine. And I asked her to make the salad dressing because I wanted to see how she made the salad dressing, because she is the goddess. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a very simple, you know, clove of garlic and salt in a mortar and pestle with like red wine vinegar and olive oil. And that was it. Mm. And, you know, you realize like, oh, it's like just simple, good ingredients that make things feel sacred. Mm-hmm. You know, the more you like throw on it, you know, sometimes the more just heavy it is. Yeah. So I was interviewing Michael Pollan for my book recently, and I said, yeah, you know, I made dinner for her. And, you know, the most important thing is, like, she came back. She wanted to come back a second time to my house for a meal. And he's like, oh, yeah. He's like, I cooked for her once, too. And, it, like, I went all out and, you know, got really fancy, and she was not happy.
Your ham changed my life. I lost all social etiquette and got up like seven times, not seven, but at least three, and ate so much of that freaking ham. Can you share any secrets with a ham?
So the first important secret is the ham itself. So this was a ham from a very happy organic pig from the Rodale Institute. Like, just bone in, you know, big hack and ham. And then, you know, the recipe is actually in my cookbook, Scratch. But, you know, you cook it, you know, it's already kind of pre-cooked, but you got to, you know, cook it because you want the fat to melt and get crispy for like, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. I stick cloves in it because that's what my mother did. And then the glaze is like orange marmalade, but you can use any kind of jam but I like, you know, the tartness of orange marmalade with mustard. You can use any kind of mustard and like brown sugar. And you put that on in the last like half hour, 45 minutes or hour, and like let it get crispy and sweet and gooey, and the fat is crispy and melts into the meat, and there you have it.
You're doing like ASMR for hungry people. And here I am. I was like, I'm not going to ask her all of the basic questions that everyone asks her. And I'm like, give us your ham secrets. ASMR. Oh, I wish I knew what it stood for, actually. But it's like, it's those people on TikTok that are like, welcome to my podcast. And then, or they'll like crinkle things, or like hairdressers do it, where it's just like the sounds throughout the day. So it's people who kind of like get off to sounds. So you were doing that with your ham recipe. Okay, moving on from food, was there more about your ham recipe you wanted to share? You know, I grew up, we always just poured ginger ale on our hams. I know. Have you heard of that? I think it's like a Pennsylvania Dutch.
I've heard Coke or Dr. Pepper, but, you know, it's sort of the same thing, but it's not, because you want the richness of the glaze, you know, and soda is not rich.
You don't have to tell me. Your ham recipe is where it's at. Okay, so going back to your Substack that we were talking about, when you tell women to act as if you already own the world, which I love, what does that look like on just any given day for a woman out there?
That's a fun one, because I'm only just learning to act that way myself, because, you know, I was born in 1962. I grew up, you know, with my mother telling me, you know, you got to be nice, you know, men don't want, you know, women who are smarter than them, you know, and it's all about like the man, you know, what, and then I was in business where I was the man, you know? But I still was like haunted by this sense of like, do you like me? Is this okay? Am I doing the right thing? And so now I'm at this point in my life where, you know, I'm 64, and it's just like, you know, you do anything you want, and you don't ask permission. I mean, my parents are dead. There's nobody to ask permission from. I'm divorced, you know, and anytime I feel that sense of like, oh, should I, shouldn't I? It's like, who cares? I'm going to do what I want. Yesterday, these guys knocked on my front porch door, and they're like roofers, and they're like, blah, 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 you know, can we give you an estimate? I'm like, no. And then, you know, but I did actually have a roof problem, though. So I was like considering, you know, and at one point they asked me, do you live alone? And I'm like, that is a personal question. Like, no, like, you know, and I'm never going to call them again. Never.
Good.
So there's just a lot of like everyday little interactions where we become submissive, mm-hmm. when we should feel like we can just say, you know, fuck off.
Yes.
You know, fuck off. Yes. It's none of your fucking business. leave me the fuck alone.
Amen. Yeah, I feel like I will try to do that. And then I immediately get so anxious. Like, I'll stand up for myself or I'll set a boundary. And then I immediately spend so much time worrying about how it made the other person feel. And so do you feel like that just comes with time and life experience? Or do you also have to practice, like, fighting that internal battle?
I think a lot of it comes with life experience. But the other thing is, you know, it depends who. There's a way to do it with kindness and love and not meanness. So, you know, I was in a family business, and there are times you want to say things, but you don't, because the bigger relationship needs to be preserved. So you have to, like, really evaluate, you know, is this a relationship that I'm willing to walk away from? You know, is this a stranger? Or is it somebody I really care about and want to, or need to, in my case, I needed to maintain a positive relationship, you know, a semi-positive relationship. So, but, I mean, I worry about, like, sometimes with my kids, you know, I don't want to push them away, but they're great. So, like, usually we can just, you know, immediately come back. But I've been coaching my youngest daughter on, like, her roommate situation. And, you know, that, you know, she's anxious. Yep. And so a lot of it is just that experience and practice and trying things and see how they work.
I love it. Okay, so I feel like we touched on this a little bit, but I'd love to hear more. You led one of the most influential health media companies in America. That's a crazy thing to say. Now you're on Substack writing much more personally. What can a personal newsletter do that a magazine can't, and vice versa?
A personal newsletter can tell the truth. Can tell the truth. Because the absolute truth is, with magazines, we were beholden to two things. One, what would advertisers support? And two, what would people buy? And at first that sounds like, well, what's wrong with what people would buy? Well, you know, we published men's health, prevention, women's health. People want to buy weight loss information. You know, how do I lose weight? How do I lose weight? I don't think that's the right thing that people should want, you know, because we've now, you know, years later, we see, like, what all the problems are with creating that false expectation. You know, like, I love women understanding now that it was, like, the Epstein class and the Lex Wexner, Victoria's Secret, that were, like, training women to feel like they should look like adolescent girls and not women. You know, so we should... If we're women, we should be women. And, you know, the BMI index was invented by a guy in 1850 who wasn't even a doctor. It's like, and it was for the average man. It was for the average man. So it's like, we just...
Why do we still use it?
They're starting to not use it anymore. Like, for the first time ever, it's not in my doctor's office on the wall anymore. So I just grew increasingly uncomfortable with that messaging that we were sending out, but that's the messaging that also made us money, which, so on Substack, I don't have to worry about making money, although I love it when people pay, but they don't have to pay. And, you know, I'm not trying to sell anything.
First of all, I love that. How do you feel about, I feel like there was sort of a pocket of time where we did get away from skinny culture a little bit. Like, it was more of a conversation. And I feel like now with the weight loss drugs, it feels like we're coming back to skinny culture. And I worry about that, especially for the younger generations. So how do you kind of, I don't want to say advocate against it, because obviously for some people it's the right thing for them. But when you feel that you're in a conversation about it, how do you continue to advocate for women looking like women? Because I love the way you said that. And it just made me feel so freaking good.
Well, this is a tough one because to me, the jury is still out on what these drugs do. And I agree that for some people, it's definitely the right thing to do. I know some people who are taking them who it's like they kind of have to, and it's great, you know. But then I know a lot of other people who are just taking them to like fit into different clothes. And, you know, among my friends who are not taking them, you know, it's like you can immediately tell when somebody's taking them. Because they get this ghoulish look in their face. You know, it's like, you know, yes, the fat goes away, but so does the, like, the lusciousness. And it makes me sad. It makes me really sad. And then it makes me, like, really angry when I see people like Oprah and Serena Williams doing it. It's like, how dare you do that? I mean, just so you can fit in, like, skinnier clothes? I mean, like, no, you know? So I just some personal information. I went to Dr. Mark Hyman, who I do not support completely, but you know he has a clinic where you can get all this testing done, and I had this you know extensive genetic test done, and the doctor, who is a woman, said, you know what, like don't even try to lose weight. It's, your genetics don't really allow for that at your age, and it was like awesome. Bring on the ham.
I'm dead. I feel like, do you have, just because I know some of your background with like shamanism and Eastern medicine, do you feel like you subscribe to both Eastern and Western medicine?
I definitely think we should take the best of all worlds, but also not believe that all worlds are the best worlds. So, you know, I'm definitely like somebody who's like tried a lot of different things. You know, I've gone to like Asian doctors. I've gone to Ayurvedic doctors. I've gone to alternative doctors, you know, and, you know, real medical doctors. Because, as you know, I had a stroke 3 years ago. So, like, I've been in the hospital. I know what it's like. And I also have three kids, so all of them are vaccinated. And I think my fundamental belief is that when you have a health issue, it's an individual journey that each of us have to embark on to find out what the answers are. And for some of us, it's a combination of food, you know, like I don't eat gluten anymore, for example, or salt, you know. Emotions, it's medicine, it's, you know, you have to kind of find what's best for you. And it's like your body telling you something needs attention that, like you have to change your perspective on. So it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
But there's no one magic bullet.
I feel like there's so many things that you've touched on that I would just love to dive deeper, like you talking about that like skinny culture is basically an Epstein class, you know, how it's linked to the patriarchy, and then about food. And I'd love to talk about like food and poverty. And I mean, I just feel like I want to listen to you all day, but I have specific questions. So I don't want to hold you hostage. And I feel like you already answered this because you said you don't eat salt, and this is just a yes or no, but do you ever eat fast food?
Not anymore.
Okay.
Like, I mean, when I was young and a young mother, I mean, I ate at, you know, we ate at McDonald's and, you know, if you're on a road trip, you know, like a fountain soda, you know, a Coke, you know, or a Slurpee, you know. The last fast food I ate was probably Chipotle. If I still like gluten, I would probably get Kentucky Fried Chicken every once in a while. You know, I love Kentucky Fried Chicken, but what I've learned to do is make it myself out of, you know, organic ingredients, organic gluten-free ingredients. So if I get the craving, you know, I make it, but like, I can't, no, I feel gross afterwards. I just feel so bad. And I don't like that feeling anymore.
I understand. I have a rough relationship with McDonald's cheeseburgers. Okay. You've said confusion is one of the biggest barriers to food system change. What exactly do you mean by that? And who is benefiting from that confusion?
So I just had a conversation with somebody about this. Like, say you are hungry and you go into the grocery store and you want to make something. Now, I'm not talking about buying something already made, but like, you want to make something and there's multiple choices of products. And every label is filled with all these different labels. You know, there's organic, there's gluten-free, there's kosher, there's non-GMO, there's, you know, all these different things. And you're not sure. You've been, you know, maybe you saw on social media that like, oh, organic isn't really what it's supposed to, you know, is what they're saying it is, or, you know, such and such is better than something else, or, and GMOs are no problem, you know, and you're confused. So honestly, you just like, look at what's the cheapest. I'm going to buy the cheapest because, you know, I want to spend my money on something else, and, or I don't have more money to spend. So who benefits from that is the giant conglomerate food companies who are poisoning the earth and treating workers like shit and living off government handouts that artificially lower their costs. So that's why they can be cheaper. So it's like a trick. Big food companies, some of whom are trying to do good things, partially. You know, there's like Unilever, Nestle, Cargill. Cargill is one of these, like, nobody knows about Cargill, but it's like the machine that runs everything, you know, the distribution system, you know, it's like, you know, it's a huge. And, you know, then there's the Walmarts and the, you know, the supermarket chains, you know, Tyson, Purdue. But, you know, like, I just found out that Purdue is, you know, one of the Purdue kids is like trying to do the right thing. So, you know, we want to reward when people are doing the right thing, and not just demonize everybody. But the way to reward companies for doing the right thing is to buy the right products. That is it. It's the only thing that matters.
I love that. And it makes my very expensive grocery choices feel better. Okay, this is an exciting question. Do you see pleasure as a part of activism?
Absolutely. I see you have a copy of my book, It's My Pleasure, that Maya and I wrote a long, long, long time ago. We actually wanted to call it The Pleasure Revolution, but the way book publishing works is if the booksellers don't like the title, you have to change it. But our whole premise was there's all these things that bring us tons of pleasure that we're taught as women to feel guilty about. So sex, chocolate, you know, sex and chocolate. That's it. When actually, like, those are healthy for us. Not only healthy for us, but like, they're the best things in life, you know? So it's really like, and, you know, I would say the same thing about organic. Like, anybody who's stepped onto an organic farm immediately feels a deep pleasure that will never be felt on a chemical farm. And that pleasure is felt by, you know, the bees and the birds and the butterflies and the bugs, you know, and the plants. And so, yeah, we want to move towards pleasure in everything.
Sex and chocolate, everyone. Get it. Okay, last question. What feels, I'm just thinking about all the noise and even the confusion you're talking about and going to the grocery store and everything we've touched on in today's political climate, what feels worth protecting?
I think our personal space is what we have to protect. And in a way, that's all we can protect, because what I'm seeing with the rise of AI, it's like, we can't trust anything anymore. You can't trust the media. I mean, the media is all owned by these giant conglomerates. And so you can trust nature and protect nature, but that's our personal space. And then, you know, going out from there, the community, protecting the community. But it's definitely interesting times. And, you know, protect the ones we love, the things we love, and hope that that spreads like a pandemic.
Hell yeah. Well, you are definitely someone that I will continue to look to as far as when there's so much noise and just chaos. I feel like, and Kathleen always describes this, you just bring so much peace and sincerity. Whenever I'm around you, I feel that way too. So I can't thank you enough for doing this for me in our chaotic sharing of the microphone. If you don't already follow Maria on social media, you should. And how do people subscribe to your Substack?
So the way to subscribe to Substack is to go to Substack, find me. You can find me under my name, Maria Rodale, or under life.unfiltered, maybe. And there should be a subscribe button on one of my posts, and just hit subscribe and put your email in. And it'll give you a choice to pay, but you don't have to pay. You can do it for free, and you'll get everything that you get if you pay. Paying is just like a thank you gift. But I am not that active anymore. I'm a lurker on Instagram and Facebook. And I'm especially a lurker on TikTok, yeah. but you know, if you really want to interact with me and stay in touch, Substack is the place to do it. And just so you know what I'm trying to do on Substack is, I don't use AI for anything. I don't use AI images. I don't use AI anything. So that is a place where I'm trying to be as real as possible. And if you're looking for real, that's the place.
If you're looking for real, Maria Rodale is where to find it. Thank you for letting me share a microphone with you today, quite literally, and for being understanding and just for being you.
Thank you so much, Veronica. This has been so fun.
Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you soon. Bye.